talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show for this June bank holiday weekend, we're looking at the D-Day landings 80 years ago this week, and we'll be finding out how they changed the course of the Second World War. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day, a pivotal moment in the history of the Second World War. On the 6th of June 1944, Allied forces launched the largest amphibious invasion in history, landing against fierce opposition on the beaches of Normandy in France. In tonight's show, we'll explore how a coalition of American, British, Canadian, and other soldiers faced fierce resistance to establish a crucial foothold in Europe. And we'll debate how D-Day helped liberate Europe from Nazi occupation. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Richard Overy is Honorary Professor of History at the University of Exeter and is an acclaimed expert on the Second World War. And his books include Blood and Runes, The Great Imperial War, 1931 to 1945, and World War II, The Definitive Visual History. Dr. Mark Jones is lecturer in global history at University College Dublin and is an expert on political violence, war and revolution. And he's the author of 1923, The Forgotten Crisis in the Year of Hitler's Coup. Professor Jonathan Fennell is Professor of the History of War and Society at King's College London and co-founder and president of the Second World War Research Group, and he's the author of Fighting the People's War, the British and Commonwealth Armies and the Second World War. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Dr. Rachel Lance, assistant consulting professor at Duke University, where she conducts research out of their hyperbaric medicine facility, and she's the author of Chamber Divers, the untold story of the D-Day scientists who changed special operations forever. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome, and Richard, I might start with you and maybe ask you to set the scene for D-Day and this massive invasion. Why was it so important for the Allies to open up this new front?
Well, for a long time, of course, Stalin had wanted the Western powers to begin a second front. I mean, he felt that the Russians were taking all the sacrifices. And there's no doubt that Roosevelt, and with less enthusiasm, Churchill, recognised that the West would have to do something in Europe other than just, occupy North Africa and invade Sicily. But there was a great deal of discussion about what form that might take. But for Roosevelt and his military commanders, there really was only one option. It was to invade Europe across the Channel, into France, and on into Germany. It's a straightforward strategy. But of course, as an operation, it's far from straightforward. And not until 43, really, had they firmed up on that commitment, firmed up enough to be able to persuade Stalin that even though they couldn't invade in 43, they would certainly invade in 44. So that was the central point, really, of Allied strategy. The Russians bashed away in the east, waiting for the West to intervene, and the West intervened when they were best able to do so.
And Mark, it's fascinating because you have Field Marshal Rommel there commanding the defence fortifications, and you have the Germans being able to prepare for an invasion. You have this huge Atlantic wall, which they think will be able to ward off an attack. But at the same time, you have, you know, a massive logistical effort being put together by the Allies. So was it inevitable that the invasion would succeed, or would it have been possible for Rommel to have successfully repelled the invasion?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Patrick. I think we asked the question, why did the Allies win the Second World War? And I think Richard has even got a book under that title among his many publications. And we usually answer that question because of their logistical might, their economic might, the mobilization of the American economy into a war economy between 1941 and 1944. It just produces so much more materials that powers an Allied victory. That's the standard answer. And then when you apply that answer to the D-Day landings, you think, well, the German defences along the coast are not strong enough to repel the force that is coming at them. And so it's an almost a standard answer that it's inevitable that the invasion will succeed. But actually, when we pause as historians and look at it in more detail, there are a couple of errors at the start of the invasion where that's not necessarily the case, where a better German command, I would argue, could have done a better job of repelling back the first the spearhead of the landing forces. And I think, you know, you mentioned the Atlantic Wall in that question, and of course that's a great propaganda term, the Atlantic Wall. You know, when we think of Germany mobilizing the European economy to resist the war, to fight back against the Soviet forces in the east, to repel the Allies in the south, and then along the coast from Denmark, really, all the way down the French coast. And we think of that, you know, and we maybe can buy into this idea that the wall is a kind of fortress, but actually it's not. It's quite weak. They have so-called Widerstandsnester, or strong points, which are bunkers, basically, along different places. Those strong points are very vulnerable to attack from the air and to attack from the sea. And because the German air defences are so weak by this point in the war, they're really exposed once the invasion force arrives. And the key thing for the Allies then is, in terms of the operation itself, is making sure that the Germans don't know where the invasion is coming. And they do this by creating decoys, by convincing the Nazi side to anticipate that the first invasion will be a fake landing to trick Germans to deploy their forces too early, and when they're actually going to invade somewhere else. And this is where Rommel is really concerned about, you know, the mobile divisions, the panzer divisions. There are 10 panzer divisions of tanks, mobile divisions in France, and he wants control over them. He doesn't actually have direct control over them, but they're crucial, because if they can get those divisions to counterattack against the spearhead when it first lands, that's the Germans' greatest chance of success. But because of the nature of the Nazi state and the rivalries within planning, within the planning and command structures, Rommel isn't even actually in control of those divisions when the invasion starts. Rommel himself is not actually even in Normandy on the day the invasion comes.
I was reading that it was by coincidence, it was his wife's birthday, so he had gone off to celebrate that, and that kind of delayed the response as well.
That's right. He even goes to Paris the day before D-Day to buy his wife shoes, which he then brings to her. And he first gets the message on her birthday, and the house is set up for a major birthday celebration. And he gets the news: you've got to come back to Normandy. The invasion is here. And I mean, we're almost thinking this is farcical. But you know, remember, at the same time, there are young German boys in those bunkers. There are Polish men. There are Russians. They're there, and they're waking up at first light to see the largest invasion armada ever. They've been bombed all night. You know, by 5,000 tons of bombs are dropped even in the morning on Normandy. You know, these are the people who are suffering because of this almost unbelievable lack of clear command structure on the German side, which all comes back to Hitler himself taking over the position of supreme commander, which means that nobody really wants to take control. Rommel has tried. He's even gone to see Hitler to ask for command of those panzer divisions, but he hasn't got it.
And Mark, I'd never realised that the famous quote about this being the longest day, the 6th of June, was actually a line from Rommel himself, who anticipated that the first 24 hours would be crucial. And I wonder, was that a mistake? Because some things I read suggested that perhaps maybe the first 24 hours weren't going to be the most important, that instead of worrying about the initial fortifications, they maybe could have been more mobile in their defence, and they could have tried to pick off the landing forces over the month, rather than trying to focus everything on that first day.
That's a great question, we could debate that. I personally think that, you know, if I look at Allied commanders and Jonathan and Richard might have a different opinion here. I think they're most worried about the start of the invasion, because if they can't get a bridgehead initially, there's no question of what they do against German counterattacks. Montgomery has fought Rommel. He's fought the Germans extensively in North Africa. He knows what they will do. He knows the counterattacks will be crucial. The counterattacks will be, the German state doesn't do retreat. Nazi Germany doesn't do retreats. It always has to be on the offensive. So it's going to counterattack even when it's pushed back. So they know they have to expect that. But on the 6th of June itself, none of that future can happen if those initial landings are not successful. And so I would argue that that's a you know, that's why history is fascinating. We can debate whether which is more important, the first landings on the 6th or the continued push into Normandy in the days and weeks that follow. But I would argue that without the ability to create a bridgehead to bring the material advantages that the Allied side has into France, they can't do anything. Just think about the amount of fuel they need. You know, they have no fuel supply in Normandy. So they're bringing fuel across in jerry cans, and they're laying a pipeline across the 80 miles between Britain and France so they can get fuel across to fuel their vehicles. Without that bridgehead, they can't bring that material across, and so they aren't going to be able to proceed with the invasion of the liberation of France.
Jonathan, this weekend a lot of people will be watching or re-watching Saving Private Ryan, and it's a brilliant movie by Spielberg, but watching that you would be quite encouraged to think that the accents and the nationality of all of those fighting on the Allied side were American, whereas of course it was a very broad coalition, and you would have found quite varied accents amongst those who were landing.
Oh, you're quite right. I mean, it's a wonderful movie. Let's not deny that. But it's all glory to the Americans. And the poor old British and Commonwealth forces sometimes don't get much of a look in. I mean, just to return to some of Mark's points, which I think are really excellent and quite interesting. I mean, everything, I think, does come down to how they're going to react, the Germans. I mean, I think that's what they're kind of aware of, that. They know that they're going to be fighting at a material disadvantage. Right from the start of the war, the Germans know that's going to be the case at the end of fighting against the Western economy. But they come to the conclusion that they can win anyway because of their superior human material, higher levels of motivation, what they have in that sense. So, yeah, we can talk a bit more about that, but it is utterly fascinating. And imagine looking out at sea on the morning of 6th of June and seeing that armada. I mean, just stunning. And it's a wonderful scene, isn't there? And another great movie about the campaign, The Longest Day, where the German soldiers are Pluscaps. He looks out and just sees the horizon covered in ships. But coming back to kind of the British and the Canadians, who sometimes get written out of it, which is strange, isn't it? Because 3 of the 5 invasion beaches are British Empire beaches. And really the main focus of the landings, the initial kind of phases, is to take Caen, which is to the east, which is in the British and Canadian sector. And in many ways, you know, the old argument goes from historians of Britain and the Empire, that the British Commonwealth forces kind of tie down the best bits of the German armed forces and allow the Americans ultimately at the end of July to break out in that great kind of battle of maneuver, Operation Cobra. And again, what happens? All glory to the Americans, because they surround and destroy vast number of German forces. But it's the British and Canadian forces who are doing so much of the heavy graft, the attritional fighting, which is sucking in German forces, causing high levels of casualties, and making it very, very difficult for the German forces to win the Battle of Materiel that eventuates in Normandy. And especially if you can cut off Normandy using air power, and Richard would probably be the best person to talk about this, which the Allies effectively do. It comes down to attrition, and the British and Commonwealth forces do a hell of a lot of that work.
And as well as the British and Canadian forces, then also a smattering of troops from Australia, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, that it kind of is this international coalition.
Well, it speaks to kind of the significance of the moment, doesn't it? This necessity for cooperation, for teamwork. I mean, this is a moment in history where you have Russia, China, the United States, Britain, all fighting on the same side in spite of their kind of ideological differences. So, you know, to move forward, to fight great evil, to succeed, cooperation rather than kind of sometimes the worst elements of competition are required.
Richard, Mark has described it as the largest invasion armada in history. And Jonathan there has talked about the huge significance of air power. And when you think about all of those different elements to it, the triumph of logistics involved in planning this, in coordinating, you know, Mark talked about those fuel lines, the way you could have put together such a vastly complex operation, the deception plans to confuse the Germans about where they were going to land, hiding what data was going to be. Never mind putting together this naval operation, the army element, the air power element, that it's almost impossible to kind of imagine how they managed to put all of these parts together and make them all work.
Well, I think the important thing to remember, of course, is that this was the great strength of the British and American war effort. They were naval powers. They could move material, equipment and men around the world wherever they wanted to. And Germany had no naval power, effectively. And so they had a good deal of practice at logistics ever since the onset of Lend-Lease in 1941. The Americans had moved things around the world. They'd embarked on a huge shipping program and so on. So logistics was at the, really at the center of the strategy of those two Western powers. It was also logistics that brought huge quantities of material to help Stalin in his war on the Eastern Front in 1944. So perhaps it shouldn't surprise us so much that this is something they can do, and they do it very well. I think we should also remember that, unlike the Germans, the British and Americans placed a great deal of emphasis on civilians planning things, people who were good at understanding logistics, or people who were good at indeed understanding intelligence or the scientific effort. So that for both the British and the Americans, this was really a joint effort between the military and civilian side of their war efforts. But the important thing, I think, that Mark touched on, and which you just touched on too, was just how vast the gap was now between German production and Anglo-American production. On D-Day, there were 12,000 aircraft available for the invasion of France, a staggering figure. There were 180 serviceable aircraft available to Air Fleet 3. It says everything. The Germans couldn't move during the day at all. The British and Americans could bomb and destroy whatever they wanted to. Now, airpair doesn't win the war, but it does mean that the Germans relied principally on their ground forces. Their ground forces, the ones with experience, are very good, but there's a limit to what they can do without extensive air power. I think the other point to bring up is that the economic and logistic success shouldn't, I think, mask the extent to which the Americans and the British and the Canadians were on a long learning curve. They were getting better all the time on the battlefield. They had not been as good as the Germans, and they weren't as good as the Germans in North Africa. They were on a long learning curve, but they were getting better. And if we look at the details of the eventual breakout Bradley organizes in Western France with Patton in the lead, it becomes a model of mobile blitzkrieg warfare. So it's not just a question of having the resources. I think it's also a question of being able to use those resources more effectively.
And looking at the number of beaches that are involved there, and Omaha Beach is famous because I think that was the best defended, and you see the most vicious fighting there. But looking at the numbers of Allied troops who get killed or wounded, they are very high numbers, and it does seem to have been that every inch of ground was being bitterly and fiercely contested.
Well, I would disagree with that. They're not high numbers at all. They're remarkably small numbers, I think, given what they're doing, invading a huge chunk of France against established defences. And indeed, they certainly expected higher casualties on all the other beaches other than Omaha, and they don't get it.
It seems like 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 11 getting killed or wounded. It seems like, certainly I would feel that if I was one of those getting ready to land, I wouldn't be hugely confident about those odds.
No, well, nobody landing would like the odds. But I think if we're looking at it in relative terms, the cost of the first couple of days of the invasion are much less than it might have been if the Germans had been able to respond more effectively. I mean, we need to look at other amphibious operations, like in the Pacific and so on, where you take extraordinary casualties in the first 24 hours, 48 hours of invading a small tropical island. D-Day, yes, of course. There were casualties, and we shouldn't forget that. On the other hand, the real bloodletting takes place later on in the next month, and then on, push into Germany later on. I think that in the end, one of the successes of D-Day actually is how much they're able to achieve at a relatively low cost.
And Jonathan, I wonder, is it possible to estimate the morale of the different sides involved? Because it certainly seems that morale was probably higher on the Allied side, that it looked like the tide was turning in their favour and that they were confident about what was coming. Whereas I'm sure on those who were defending the beaches, it must have been a much different thing to consider. And it must have been fairly demoralising to see such a vast armada in front of them.
Yeah, listen, I think you're right, Patrick. We can think about the material factors, the kind of ratios in terms of material and weapons. We can talk, and maybe we should talk a bit more about some of the kind of conceptual dynamics, the doctrine, how the armies went about fighting. But war is always a human dynamic, right? It comes down to young men and women being willing to cross the fire-swept zone and risk their one and only life to get the job done. And so looking at dynamics of morale, I think is hugely important. Before I do that, can I jump back? Because I have some of the numbers here for, you know, landings. And I think they're really quite interesting and kind of shed a bit more light on what's happening on D-Day itself. So there's a wonderful book by a guy called Peter Lieb, looks at Operation Normandy. And he says there's about 100 men on Utah Beach, that's defenders, 175 on Gold, 300 on Juno, 370 on Sword. And in Omaha, you know, the famous beach, there's about 500 Wehrmacht soldiers deployed, including local reserves, maybe about 1,000. So by the evening of D-Day, and there's almost 35,000 soldiers from the 1st U.S. and 29th Infantry Divisions landing on Omaha. And overall, we can talk about 30,000 Germans in the invasion area and facing about 150,000 Allied men by the end of the day. So, you know, the ratios are in the Allied favor. And much of the kind of literature from the experience of, say, British soldiers is they're shocked by how poor the Germans perform, in fact. You know, we talked about how important that initial response was going to be. Well, actually, the British landing troops think, actually, the Germans don't perform that well. And that is why the casualties are so much lower. And come back to, say, one of Mark's original points about intelligence. You know, intelligence specialists reckon that if the Germans had guessed better over where the landings would take place, they could have had an extra perhaps 20 to 50,000 soldiers in the area of the landing. And that could have made all the difference, right? So there's, you know, Richard is quite right. I mean, the technical brilliance on the Allied side is stunning. You know, experts really, really matter. And the Allies did so many of the basics very well. And it does appear when you look at the details that the Germans do some of the basics not so well. So returning to morale, I mean, so ultimately, for all the advantages in materiel, and they are extreme, young men have to get the job done. And there's no doubt that the morale, you know, it fluctuates over the course of the campaign. It's very high at the start because everybody's convinced that this is the moment that the war can be won. You know, they know that this is history in the making. But as the campaign grinds into a series of attritional battles, morale starts to crumble a little bit. We see sickness rates really, really jumping amongst British forces and also amongst American forces, and later on also amongst Canadian forces. The morale reports and the censorship reports, so, you know, soldiers write home, those letters are turned into summaries by the authorities to try and understand how the soldiers are feeling. They point to kind of a drop in kind of willingness to fight. And in many ways, it's a real battle for the Allied authorities to keep the soldiers motivated to fight, because it's, as you pointed out yourself, Patrick, casualties are very high by June and July. They're as high as 3rd Ypres, or what we remember as Passchendaele, you know, that memory of the First World War that's seared into kind of British popular culture. It is really rough stuff. And so on the whole, the Allies managed to keep their men on the fight. Sometimes it's about offering them ideas of a better future. At other times, it's really prosaic stuff. You know, you see examples in the censorship reports where soldiers are exhausted and then they're brought out of the line. They're allowed to have showers for the first time in 5 or 6 weeks. And they're given new cigarettes, you know, the basic stuff, the little things that makes human beings feel seen and valued. And all of a sudden they're willing to go again. So we can kind of talk about the prosaic and the transcendental, you know, ideology, but also the basics. And many of those factors play out with the Germans.
And Mark, it is interesting. There is that morale issue, but it's also, I think, getting a sense of how it's not just soldiers on the ground. You also have the crucial role of air power. You have these gliders. You have, you know, tanks coming on. You know, that it's this hugely coordinated, you know, multifaceted invasion where there's all these different elements. There's the bombardments before that. It's not just one type of attack.
That's right. I mean, just thinking about some of the points Jonathan was making, you know, morale is different in different units of the armed forces. And, you know, you have what we would call special forces leading the attack. And those are men who volunteer for those roles. So they volunteer to be in airborne or paratrooper units, to jump out of planes, to be among the first people to land in Normandy. They have really high rates of motivation. They've chosen that role in the initial invasion. I think one thing is, it's worth thinking about, the Allied commanders, the British side in particular, have learnt from the First World War. So they're not punishing people for desertion in the same way. They're not executing their soldiers if they refuse to fight. That's not the same case on the German side. From this point on in the war, the compulsion to fight gets stronger and stronger on the German side, because the extremists within the regime will punish their soldiers for not fighting. And I think that makes a huge difference. I think when Jonathan was speaking there about the numbers on the beaches, there's one thing I want to add in. You know, you're talking small numbers, tiny numbers of men in these so-called nests with machine guns. And, you know, the German, I think it's the MG-42, it can fire 23 bullets a second, which is a terrifying thing to contemplate, but it can't fire at that rate for very long. So it heats up, and then it gets too hot, and the soldier firing it can't, you know, they have to stop firing. And at that point in time, they're sitting ducks. You know, they're sitting ducks both in terms of the soldiers coming off the landing craft who can fire back, and they've been sitting ducks in terms of their position with regard to the naval and aerial bombardment of the beaches. So their morale is not about defending the Reich or about ideas of Nazi superiority. Some of them maybe believe that, but most of them simply want to survive. They are fighting to survive. And that is a different kind of morale to you know, what Jonathan is talking about in terms of getting ready to you know, liberate France, to get to Paris, you know, to defeat Nazi Germany. It's a different kind. The momentum is with the Allies, which we talk in military history, you know, it's the offensive is harder. You have more casualties when you're on the offensive. But the offensive also has a goal, the momentum to go somewhere. And for the German side, fighting to survive is their main reason for keeping going at this point in time, I think.
Well, tonight we are talking about the D-Day landings 80 years ago, as we remember what happened and the impact it had on the Second World War. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Dr. Rachel Lance about newly declassified documents which tell the untold story of the D-Day scientists who changed special operations forever. And we'll be talking to Rachel right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are remembering the D-Day landings on this, the 80th anniversary, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Rachel Lance, Assistant Consulting Professor at Duke University, where she conducts research out of their hyperbaric medicine facility, and she's the author of a new book, Chamber Divers, The Untold Story of the D-Day Scientists Who Changed Special Operations Forever. Rachel, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel, can you maybe tell us about some of these newly declassified documents and how they tell us these elements involving technology, involving breakthroughs that really are such an important part of the D-Day story as well?
Working with documents that are classified or recently declassified is always a bit of a guessing game, because you're essentially trying to negotiate with the government to get them released secrets. In this case, it was a game of connecting documents that are stored across the UK, some already released and then some already that I had to request permissions for. But what they connected together, once you were able to unite them, was this story of the group of scientists who were working with the government in order to make underwater breathing possible for the first time. So this is an era before Jacques Cousteau in England, in the UK. They're realizing that they will eventually need to cross the channel, bring the war to Hitler on the mainland. And the way that they decided to do that was through diving in miniature submarines. And these documents, when you put them together, paint that picture of how that was done.
And that this was crucially important in terms of having that also important reconnaissance in advance, but also in terms of the invasion itself. So these were things they had to get right, because as you show in your opening, previous attempts at amphibious invasions had failed because those elements weren't there.
That's absolutely right. All previous attempts at amphibious invasions had been either very small and used the element of stealth, or had been complete debacles. We saw that with Gallipoli in World War I, and we saw that with Dieppe in World War II. So what the Allied countries realized is that they needed to revise their approach, and they couldn't just keep throwing bodies at the problem. They needed to use technology and smarts instead in order to do this in a more planned way.
And Rachel, one of your chapters is called The Unremembered, and there are these people who played such a crucial role in the story, men and women who really haven't gotten the recognition they deserve. People like Haldane, and then people like Helen Spurway, who seems to have had her work almost stolen from her and the credit given to men rather than to where it really belonged.
I think stolen is the exact right word. She did all of this incredible work. She essentially came in and was responsible for providing the Allies with the first safety guidelines for how to dive underwater. And then there was one particular government agent who essentially said, "This is nice. It's mine now." Applied his own name to it and has taken credit for the intervening 80 years. Now that we're on the anniversary of D-Day, I think of this as this wonderful opportunity to talk about the people who contributed but maybe haven't had their stories told yet.
And Dr. Helen Spurway is this remarkable figure. And even the way because they didn't have ways of testing these pieces of technology, they experimented on themselves.
That's exactly right. They started out with these submarine escape apparatuses. And because they were designed to be used in a sunken submarine scenario, which is obviously very extreme, very desperate for people to get out, right? There aren't a lot of options there. They had never really been thoroughly tested. So the second that people actually start using them, which happens first in June 1939 with the sinking of the HMS Thetis, they start to realize that these devices and the physiology of submarine escape is not as simple as they thought. When the blitz starts and the bombing starts, of course, the Allied militaries, all these countries are joining together. There's not a lot of good ways to do this type of large-scale scientific testing. So the scientists start using the people that they know will show up to lab every day, and that was themselves. So they did it all on themselves to try and make it possible for the Allied military to use in the field.
And really remarkable people. Elizabeth Jerman, who again was this very significant figure who made an important contribution to the technology that and to testing it that helped again make this D-Day invasion possible.
That's right. Elizabeth Jerman was the group's secretary. But of course, this was reflective of the time period. She was actually a highly qualified scientist on her own. And this woman was climbing into these test tanks herself. She was putting on the equipment, climbing into the test tanks. She, at one point, had a seizure so powerful, she cracked her own spine. And she lived the rest of her life never being able to talk about it, never being able to explain why. But what she was working on was essentially the guidance that was handed off to underwater personnel in the days prior to D-Day to keep them safe.
So why were all of these experiments and breakthroughs given classification markings until really the start of the 21st century in 2001? Why were they kept secret for so long?
Part of that is that they were genuinely a secret in terms of the tactic. And part of that is just government bureaucracy. So essentially what the government will do is they will keep something a secret until it becomes so globally known that they might as well declassify it anyway. So once we see the guidelines are published, the public knows about them, people start to use them about scuba diving, the first documents related to this were really starting to be declassified in the 1970s. But the rest of them were still kept and still held because a lot of it was the process of how this was done. And that was maintained a secret until the 21st century. So some of them. But then you have the government bureaucracy come in, right? Sometimes the government doesn't actually review these things until someone asks for it. And then it becomes a bit of a catch-22. You have to know the thing is there in order to ask for it. And you have to know you want it. And then the government will review it and release it. So that was part of the process that I had to go through when I was writing this book as well, was this process of negotiation to say, hey, we already know what's in this, despite not really knowing what's in this.
And it is fascinating the way when we think of D-Day landings, we think of Operation Neptune and the broader Operation Overlord. We think of it in terms of the naval and aerial bombardment, the troops landing on the beaches, the intense conflict. But we don't often think about the wider dimensions, the way that advanced technology and new technological breakthroughs were being used to help make the whole thing possible and to counteract the German defences.
That's exactly right. And I think D-Day is taught probably a little bit differently in America than in the UK. But the way that we talk about World War II here, it's very much December 7th, 1941, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Then a magical time warp occurs, and we're at June 6, 1944. I really wanted to focus on that period in between where the countries were very much at war. The civilian population is being hugely affected. But what were they doing? Why was there that gap or apparent gap before they were able to make these successful landings? And the answer is they needed that time for the development of technology and science, whether it's the portable mulberry harbors or whether it's the story in this book, which was turning humans into fish.
Well, Rachel, thanks so much for joining us tonight to talk about the untold story of the D-Day scientists who changed special operations forever. Rachel's new book is called Chamber Divers. It's published in hardback by Bedford Square Publishers for this 80th anniversary. And Dr. Rachel Lance from Duke University, working at their hyperbaric medicine facility, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be rejoined by our panel as we talk about the liberation of Paris and what the D-Day invasion meant for the course of the Second World War. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history as we remember the D-Day landings 80 years ago. I'm rejoined by my panel of experts, Professor Richard Overy of the University of Exeter, Dr. Mark Jones of University College Dublin, and Professor Jonathan Fennell of King's College London. Mark, tell me about the French involvement then and the role of the French resistance. Did they play any part then in the story of the landings or the invasion in the months ahead?
Yeah, I think that's an important topic to touch upon. I guess if you were to ask a traditional French nationalist historian, they would probably say the French resistance role is much more important than maybe a lot of historians on the British and American side might say. I think that their numbers are relatively small, and France itself is in a condition of civil war, arguably, at this point in time. You know, you have the French state, which exists, Vichy exists, the administration exists under German occupation, and you then have fascist groups that have grown in the months before the invasion who are willing to fight against the resistance. And so that's why that civil war paradigm is used to capture the nature of the situation in France. The kind of classic romanticized view that we have of the French resistance on the eve of Normandy is that they're listening to BBC and they're getting coded messages. And those coded messages are phrases that are unintelligible to anybody, but they come through and they alert the resistance in Normandy. The time is now, D-Day has started, and they're given specific targets to attack police stations, to attack infrastructure. In the months before the landing, their goal has been to focus upon German mobility. And that means, you know, if the invasion is to succeed, the crucial point is that the less Germans can move, the better it is for the Allied side. And so the French resistance will be joining and attacking fuel depots and railway lines. You know, once the invasion comes, as Richard has said earlier, it's the control of the skies that means that Germans can't move rather than the heroic role of the resistance. So I think, you know, if you pushed me on it, and other panelists might disagree, but if you pushed me on it, I would say they play a really important symbolic role and a really important role in creating a salvageable French national story from the Second World War. But when it comes to the actual fighting, however heroic the individual members of the French resistance may have been, it is not as significant as those salvageable national stories make it out to be.
And Richard, it is interesting how they are able to push the Germans back. The Germans are forced to retreat and Paris is liberated in August 1944. So it is quite a rapid advance, it seems, by the Allies.
Yeah, I mean, we have to recognise, I think, that the German defences in France, it's a very fragile shield. It's very difficult to resupply with men or with equipment. They get a handful of tanks when they've lost 1,000. It is always going to, you know, as long as the Allies keep pressing, it's going to break at some point. In fact, Hitler tells them, of course, they have to stand fast. But he does that because he realizes they've got no means really to retreat effectively. And when the brittle shield breaks, as it does by August, then it's a headlong retreat. It's catastrophic. The Germans, any German soldiers who can survive, make it as fast as they can towards the German frontier, where they do set up, of course, another very solid line, which takes the Allies a long time to penetrate. But once, you know, once it's reached a certain level, a critical level, in terms of a loss of men and of equipment and so on, there's a point at which they can't continue. Now, Hitler drafts in his famous fireman, Model, at the end, to try to see if he can do something about, you know, stemming the tide. And he's there for 2 days, and he really, you know, writes back to Hitler and says, no, there's nothing to do. And he's quite right. He is there supervising the retreat. And the retreat, when it comes, is, you know, a calamity. But it's, you know, by that stage, more or less inevitable.
And Richard, it's interesting the way it does capture the popular imagination. There is something about the D-Day landings that inspires writers and filmmakers. It seems to capture the imagination of the Americans in particular, and there is always very significant commemorations every year, and it's something that you see American presidents come over to Normandy for it, and it's something that becomes a hugely important part of how the Second World War is remembered.
It is indeed. But of course, I think we need to recognize that this is, you know, the amphibious landing like this is a moment of real drama and everything it involves. At the same time as the D-Day invasion, of course, Stalin is authorized Operation Bagration in the east, which is a colossal campaign which destroys Army Group Center in the matter of a few weeks. You know, but nobody makes films about Operation Bagration. It's, you know, yet another Soviet ground operation. But the amphibious operation, bringing all those men, training them, bringing them all there on the ships, storming the cliffs and the beaches, driving the Germans back. It's it's a story of high drama. In fact, it's difficult to imagine how you can't make a decent book or a decent film out of it. And that's captured the imagination, just as in for the American public, of course, some of the key amphibious operations in the Pacific, Iwo Jima, for example, have also captured their imagination. There's something about sea to land, I think, which has a special attraction to it.
Jonathan, is it commemorated and remembered the same way in the Commonwealth countries? And I wonder if you were to look at how it's remembered in Canada or remembered in Britain, it doesn't quite seem to have the same force or resonance, and maybe I'm wrong, as it does in the United States.
I think it probably does have the same resonance, although maybe not the same ability to pump out movies and kind of cultural reference points. I mean, it is seen as a moment of high drama, as Richard articulates. I mean, we've got to remember, for me, it is the decisive moment. And I think that's something that the perspective the panel potentially shares. I mean, you look at the casualty rates for German forces, and they jump just almost exponentially in the summer of 1944 with D-Day, Normandy, and Bagration. They far outweigh any of the casualties. You know, for much of the early parts of the war, the Germans aren't suffering that many casualties at all. Stalingrad is a kind of spike, but this is something on a different level. And you can read then in some of the morale reports, the censorship reports from soldiers that kind of plot this interaction between home and front as people are trying to make sense of what's going on around them. You can sense all of a sudden there's a slight change in tone, a realization that actually we cannot come back from this. And so, you know, this is the moment where victory is in large measure achieved. And it is something that I think the Commonwealth countries, Britain and Canada and elsewhere, feel great sense of pride. It's an astonishing moment of technical brilliance. The Allies are fighting in three domains, in the air, the land and the sea. The Germans are really fighting only in one, on land. This is the superiority of the Allied way of thinking about war. It's an astonishing victory.
And Mark, it is an astonishing victory, and the way it's remembered, the way it's commemorated in the years ahead, it really becomes such an important part of the story.
That's right. I think we should add, though, it's a tremendous moment of hope. Anne Frank is in hiding since the summer of 1942, and she's writing her diary. Her diary writes about the landings and D-Day, and she writes about that Churchill wanted to go with the landings, and she writes what a great man this man is. And that's hope. You know, if you're in hiding and you're waiting for liberation, the fact that the Allies are coming from the West is a real thing to hope for. Unfortunately for the Frank family, they're discovered few weeks after the Allied landings. But for all those who want to see democracy win, this is a great moment of hope, because remember that the war, there are wars within the war. I've spoken about the French Civil War on the eve of the invasion. The Second World War at this point in time is shifting to being about what comes next. And the coalition that is united to defeat Nazism is facing the challenge of what are we fighting for next? What's the order going to be? And on the German side, there are a lot of people who say one day that we will switch. We will join with the Allies and we will fight against the Soviets, who are our ideological enemies. You know, this is wishful thinking, extreme wishful thinking on their part. But it is that point in time where the war is changing. Perhaps something that needs to be maybe remembered more when we think about D-Day and why the D-Day landings were so important and so necessary is that without them, the future of Europe that becomes the Cold War would be vastly, vastly different. I think there's something about jumping off a landing craft and running onto a beach that captures people's imagination, and that makes it so important for memories. I think the context I would explain, Paris is liberated the same time as Warsaw, uprising takes place, and the death toll in Paris is between 1 and 2,000. The death toll in Warsaw is 150 times greater than that in the same time frame. So that reminds us of how important the Eastern Front is for the Second World War as a whole. And I would hope that most people now would be able to remember that while they commemorate the landings themselves. But I think that's, in some cases, that's not done. In some cases, it's still very much a Western narrative, which downplays the importance of the Eastern Front. And that statistic, and that reminder of what's happening in the East is really what I would encourage people to think about as they focus on the landings themselves during this anniversary, to think about how important the wider context is, because it is a global war. And those global contexts add up all the time. The more you study the war from a global perspective, as Richard's written about in his book, which I'd encourage everyone to read, it is the global theatres are influencing each other all the time. And that's ultimately what happens on the beaches in Normandy is connected to what's happening all over the world.
I think that's a brilliant point because, yeah, we tend to sometimes see it in terms of D-Day and this war on the Western side and almost forget that the Soviets are fighting this bitter war on the Eastern side. And without that part of the war, the shape of it could have been very different.
But also without the Allied landings, the Soviets could push all the way to Paris and you could have an entirely communist Europe. And that didn't happen thanks to the sacrifices made by those men who, as Jonathan said, risked their one and only life charging up those beaches.
So, Jonathan, important legacies then with D-Day. What would you see as the most important then in terms of its impact on the war and, I suppose, the course of world history?
I love this idea of hope. I mean, amongst all the suffering, the hatred, the loss, the sorrow, the ways that we do remember the war, out of it did emerge, I think, for a time, certainly a better world. The United Nations, a focus on greater levels of social justice, I think, domestically, focus on greater levels of cooperation internationally. We must also remember, right, that China is playing a huge role as well in tying down Axis forces during this period. So we have what's happening on the Eastern Front, the Western Front in Europe, and then what's happening in the Pacific and, of course, mainland China. So it's an indication of what can be achieved when people work together, when countries work together, when they find common ground in spite of all our differences. And maybe in this moment at the moment, which feels very much like the 1930s at times, doesn't it? Maybe we can see from the perspective of 1945 that maybe we can work out some of these issues and work together and find, work as hard for peace as those soldiers did for victory in 1944, 1945.
Richard, I will leave the final word to you. 80 years on from the D-Day landings, how should we remember them?
Well, I think we should remember them in the way that Jonathan and Mark have said. Of course, this was an extremely important operation for Western strategy, the decisive operation, and it was successful and Western Europe was liberated. I think we need to remember that this is for Western Europe, that D-Day is really, it's a day which is going to secure the Western world and our post-1945 Western world. What's happening in the East is something different. Stalin's Russia is not campaigning for democracy in our sense.
And the fate of Eastern Europe is different from the fate of Western Europe. But D-Day is important for shaping the way in which the West survives the war and goes on to embrace what we now regard as, you know, as 80 years of Western success.
Well, I think that's a good note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Richard Overy of the University of Exeter, Dr. Mark Jones of University College Dublin, Professor Jonathan Fennell of King's College London, and we also heard from Dr. Rachel Lance of Duke University. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and to Hannah Flam on research, and of course, Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.